This is Audible.
Phoenix Books presents Conversations with God, an uncommon dialogue. Book 1. Written by Neil Donald Walsh. This unabridged performance by Neil Donald Walsh with Edward Asner and Ellen Burstyn features exclusive interviews by Michael Toms with James Redfield, Ram Dass, Shakti Gwynn, and Neil Donald Walsh, and music composed and performed by Michael Misch. It is copyright 2014 Phoenix Books and has been digitally remastered from the original 2007 Phoenix Books sound recording.
This is Neil Donald Walsh. I'm not a minister, I'm not a theologian, I'm not a scientist or philosopher, I'm a regular person, just like you. I don't have a college degree or a long list of impressive credentials. I've lived a life in which I've made more than my share of mistakes and in which I've faced many of the same day-to-day challenges and questions which you have faced. But by 1992, these challenges had increased to a point where I found myself living in complete frustration. Nothing in my life seemed to be working. And in utter despair, one middle of the night, I wrote an angry letter to God. I wanted to know why my life wasn't working, what it would take to get it to work, to get it right. This all took place just before Easter of that year, and when I finished my letter, something incredible happened. Something which has changed my life, and the lives of thousands of other people, forevermore. I began hearing answers to the questions I had been asking in my letter. And I began writing what I was hearing as fast as I could. When the answers ran out, I asked more questions and got more answers. Naturally, I began asking questions as fast as I could think of them. And I got answers as fast as I could write. What started that night, a very uncommon dialogue, continued for nearly a year. I remember the very first exchange I had in this dialogue. I had just finished with my letter. To my surprise, as I scribbled out the last of my bitter, unanswerable questions and prepared to toss my pen aside, my hand remained poised over the paper as if held there by some invisible force. Abruptly, the pen began moving on its own. I had no idea what I was about to write, but an idea seemed to be coming, so I decided to flow with it. Out came,
"Do you really want an answer to all these questions, or are you just venting?"
I blinked, and then my mind came up with a reply. I wrote that down, too. "Both. I'm venting, sure, but if these questions have answers, I'd sure as hell like to hear them."
"You are sure as hell about a lot of things, but wouldn't it be nice to be sure as heaven?"
And I wrote, "What is that supposed to mean?" Before I knew it, I had begun a conversation, and I was not writing so much as taking dictation. What you are about to hear is a reading of a large portion of that dialogue. I hope you receive benefit from listening to it. The dialogue begins with a very simple question, actually. How does God talk? And to whom?
"I talk to everyone.
All the time."
"The question is not to whom do I talk,
but who listens."
"First, let's exchange the word talk with the word communicate. It's a much better word, a much fuller, more accurate one. When we try to speak to each other, me to you, you to me, we are immediately constricted by the unbelievable limitation of words. For this reason, I do not communicate by words alone. In fact, rarely do I do so. My most common form of communication is through feeling. Feeling is the language of the soul. If you want to know what's true for you about something, look to how you're feeling about it. Feelings are sometimes difficult to discover, and often even more difficult to acknowledge. Yet hidden in your deepest feelings is your highest truth. The trick is to get to those feelings. I will show you how. Again, if you wish. I also communicate with thought. Thought and feelings are not the same, although they can occur at the same time. In communicating with thought, I often use images and pictures. For this reason, thoughts are more effective than mere words as tools of communication. In addition to feelings and thoughts, I also use the vehicle of experience as a grand communicator. And finally, when feelings and thoughts and experience all fail, I use words. Words are really the least effective communicator. They are most open to misinterpretation, most often misunderstood. Why is that? It is because of what words are. Words are merely utterances, noises that stand for feelings, thoughts, and experience. They are symbols, signs, insignias. They're not truth. They're not the real thing. Words may help you understand something. Experience allows you to know. Yet there are some things you cannot experience. So I've given you other tools of knowing, and these are called feelings. And so too, thoughts. Now, the supreme irony here is that you've all placed so much importance on the Word of God and so little on the experience. In fact, you place so little value on experience that when what you experience of God differs from what you've heard of God, you automatically discard the experience and own the words, when it should be just the other way around. Your experience and your feelings about a thing represent what you factually and intuitively know about that thing. Words can only seek to symbolize what you know, and can often confuse what you know. These, then, are the tools with which I communicate. Yet they are not the methods, for not all feelings, not all thoughts, not all experience, and not all words are from me. Many words have been uttered by others in my name. Many thoughts and many feelings have been sponsored by causes not of my direct creation. Many experiences result from these. The challenge is one of discernment. The difficulty is knowing the difference between messages from God and data from other sources. Discrimination is a simple matter with the application of a basic rule. Mine is always your highest thought, your clearest word, your grandest feeling. Anything less is from another source. Now, the task of differentiation becomes easy, for it should not be difficult even for the beginning student to identify the highest, the clearest, and the grandest. Yet will I give you these guidelines. The highest thought is always that thought which contains joy. The clearest words are those words which contain truth. The grandest feeling is that feeling which you call love. Joy, truth, love. These three are interchangeable, and one always leads to the other. It matters not in which order they are placed. Having with these guidelines determined which messages are mine and which have come from another source, the only question remaining is whether my messages will be heeded. Most of my messages are not. Some because they seem too good to be true. Others because they seem too difficult to follow. Many because they are simply misunderstood. Most because they are not received. My most powerful messenger is experience, and even this you ignore. Especially this you ignore. Your world would not be in its present condition were you to have simply listened to your experience. The result of your not listening to your experience is that you keep reliving it over and over again. For my purpose will not be thwarted, nor my will be ignored. You will get the message, sooner or later. I will not force you to, however. I will never coerce you. For I have given you a free will, the power to do as you choose. And I will never take that away from you, ever. And so I will continue sending you the same messages over and over again throughout the millennia and to whatever corner of the universe you occupy. Endlessly will I send you my messages until you have received them and held them close, calling them your own. My messages will come in 100 forms, in 1,000 moments across 1,000,000 years. You cannot miss them if you truly listen. You cannot ignore them once truly heard. Thus will our communication begin in earnest. Where in the past, you have only talked to me, praying to me, interceding with me, beseeching me. Yet now can I talk back to you, even as I'm doing here.
How can I know this communication is from God? How do I know this is not my own imagination?
What would be the difference? Do you not see that I could just as easily work through your imagination as anything else? I will bring you the exact right thoughts, words, or feelings at any given moment, suited precisely to the purpose at hand, using one device or several. You will know these words are from me because you, of your own accord, have never spoken so clearly. Had you already spoken so clearly on these questions, you would not be asking them.
To whom does God communicate? Are there special people? Are there special times?
All people are special. And all moments are golden. There's no person and there's no time one more special than another. Many people choose to believe that God communicates in special ways and only with special people. This removes the mass of the people from responsibility for hearing my message, much less receiving it, which is another matter, and allows them to take someone else's word for everything. You don't have to listen to me, for you've already decided that others have heard from me on every subject, and you have them to listen to. By listening to what other people think they heard me say, you don't have to think at all. This is the biggest reason for most people turning from my messages on a personal level. If you acknowledge that you are receiving my messages directly, then you are responsible for interpreting them. It is far safer and much easier to accept the interpretation of others, even others who have lived 2,000 years ago, than seek to interpret the message you may very well be receiving in this moment now. Yet I invite you to a new form of communication with God, a two-way communication. In truth, it is you who have invited me, for I have come to you in this form, right now, in answer to your call.
Why do some people, take Christ for example, seem to hear more of your communication than others?
Because some people are willing to actually listen. They're willing to hear. They're willing to remain open to the communication even when it seems scary or crazy or downright wrong.
We should listen to God even when what's being said seems wrong?
Especially when it seems wrong. If you think you are right about everything, who needs to talk with God? Go ahead and act on all that you know. But notice that you've all been doing that since time began. And look at what shape the world is in. Clearly, you've missed something. Obviously, there's something you don't understand. That which you do understand must seem right to you, because right is a term you use to designate something with which you agree. What you've missed will, therefore, appear at first to be wrong. The only way to move forward on this is to ask yourself, what would happen if everything I thought was wrong was actually right? Every great scientist knows about this. When what a scientist does is not working, a scientist sets aside all of the assumptions and starts over. All great discoveries have been made from a willingness and ability to not be right. And that's what's needed here. You cannot know God until you stop telling yourself that you already know God. You cannot hear God until you stop thinking that you've already heard God. I cannot tell you my truth until you stop telling me yours.
But my truth about God comes from you.
Who said so?
Others.
What others?
Leaders, ministers, rabbis, priests, books, the Bible, for heaven's sake.
Those are not authoritative sources.
They aren't?
No.
Then what is?
Listen to your feelings. Listen to your highest thoughts. Listen to your experience. Whenever any of these differ from what you've been told by your teachers or read in your books, forget the words. Words are the least reliable purveyor of truth.
There is so much I want to say to you, so much I want to ask. I don't know where to begin. For instance, why is it that you do not reveal yourself? If there really is a God, and you're it, why do you not reveal yourself in a way we can all understand?
I have done so over and over. I'm doing so again right now.
No, I mean by a method of revelation that is incontrovertible, that cannot be denied.
Such as?
Such as appearing right now before my eyes.
I am doing so right now.
Where?
Everywhere you look.
No, I mean in an incontrovertible way.
What way would that be? In what form or shape would you have me appear?
In the form or shape you actually have.
That would be impossible. For I have no form or shape, you understand. I could adopt a form or shape that you could understand. But then everyone would assume that what they have seen is the one and only form and shape of God, rather than a form or shape of God, one of many. People believe I am what they see me as, rather than what they do not see. But I am the great unseen, not what I cause myself to be in any particular moment. In a sense, I am what I am not. It is from the am-notness that I come, and to it I always return. Yet when I come in one particular form or another, a form in which I think people can understand me, people assign me that form forevermore. And should I come in any other form to any other people, the first say I did not appear to the second, because I did not look to the second as I did to the first, nor say the same things. So how could it have been me? You see, then, it matters not in what form or in what manner I reveal myself. Whatever manner I choose and whatever form I take, none will be incontrovertible.
But if you did something that would evidence the truth of who you are, beyond doubt or question...
There are still those who would say it is of the devil, or simply someone's imagination, or any cause other than me. If I revealed myself as God Almighty, King of heaven and earth, and moved mountains to prove it, there are those who would say, it must have been Satan. And such is as it should be. For God does not reveal God's self to God's self from or through outward observation, but through inward experience. And when inward experience has revealed God's self, outward observation is not necessary. And if outward observation is necessary, inward experience is not possible. If then revelation is requested, it cannot be had. For the act of asking is a statement that it is not there, that nothing of God is now being revealed. Such a statement produces the experience. For your thought about something is creative and your word is productive, and your thought and your word together are magnificently effective in giving birth to your reality. Therefore shall you experience that God is not now revealed, for if God were, you would not ask God to be.
Does that mean I cannot ask for anything I want? Are you saying that praying for something actually pushes it away from us?
This is a question which has been asked through the ages, and has been answered whenever it has been asked. Yet you have not heard the answer, or will not believe it. The question is answered again in today's terms and today's language, thusly. You will not have that for which you ask, nor can you have anything you want. This is because your very request is a statement of lack, and your saying you want a thing only works to produce that precise experience, wanting, in your reality. The correct prayer is, therefore, never a prayer of supplication, but a prayer of gratitude. When you thank God in advance for that which you choose to experience in your reality, you in effect acknowledge that it is there, in effect. Thankfulness is thus the most powerful statement to God, an affirmation that even before you ask, I have answered. Therefore, never supplicate, appreciate.
But what if I am grateful to God in advance for something and it never shows up? That could lead to disillusionment and bitterness.
Gratitude cannot be used as a tool with which to manipulate God, a device with which to fool the universe. You cannot lie to yourself. Your mind knows the truth of your thoughts. You are saying, "Thank you, God, for such and such," all the while being very clear that it isn't there in your present reality. You can't expect God to be less clear than you, and so produce it for you. God knows what you know, and what you know is what appears as your reality.
But how then can I be truly grateful for something I know is not there?
Faith. If you have but the faith of a mustard seed, you shall move mountains. You come to know it is there because I said it is there. Because I said that, even before you ask, I shall have answered. Because I said, and have said to you in every conceivable way, through every teacher you can name, that whatsoever you shall choose, choosing it in my name, so shall it be.
Yet so many people say that their prayers have gone unanswered.
No prayer, and a prayer is nothing more than a fervent statement of what is so, goes unanswered. Every prayer, every thought, every statement, every feeling is creative. To the degree that it is fervently held as truth, to that degree will it be made manifest in your experience. When it is said that a prayer has not been answered, what has in actuality happened is that the most fervently held thought, word, or feeling has become operative. Yet what you must know, and here's the secret, is that always it is the thought behind the thought, what might be called the sponsoring thought, that is the controlling thought. If therefore you beg and supplicate, there seems a much smaller chance that you will experience what you think you are choosing. Because the sponsoring thought behind every supplication is that you do not have now what you wish. That sponsoring thought becomes your reality. The only sponsoring thought which could override this thought is the thought held in faith that God will grant whatever is asked without fail. Some people have such faith, and very few. The process of prayer becomes much easier when, rather than having to believe that God will always say yes to every request, one understands intuitively that the request itself is not necessary. Then the prayer is a prayer of thanksgiving. It is not a request at all, but a statement of gratitude for what is so.
When you say that a prayer is a statement of what is so, are you saying that God does nothing, that everything which happens after a prayer is a result of the prayer's action?
If you believe that God is some omnipotent being who hears all prayers, says yes to some, no to others, and maybe, but not now, to the rest, you are mistaken. By what rule of thumb would God decide? If you believe that God is the creator and decider of all things in your life, you are mistaken. God is the observer, not the creator. And God stands ready to assist you in living your life, but not in the way you might expect. It is not God's function to create or uncreate the circumstances or conditions of your life. God created you in the image and likeness of God. You have created the rest through the power God has given you. God created the process of life and life itself as you know it. Yet God gave you free choice to do with life as you will. In this sense, your will for you is God's will for you. You are living your life the way you are living your life, and I have no preference in the matter. This is the grand illusion in which you have engaged, that God cares one way or the other what you do. I do not care what you do, and that is hard for you to hear. Yet do you care what your children do when you send them out to play? Is it a matter of consequence to you whether they play tag or hide and seek or pretend? No, it is not. Because you know they are perfectly safe. You have placed them in an environment which you consider friendly and very okay. Of course, you will always hope that they do not hurt themselves. And if they do, you will be right there to help them, heal them, allow them to feel safe again, to be happy again, to go and play again another day. But whether they choose hide and seek or pretend will not matter to you the next day either. You will tell them, of course, which games are dangerous to play. But you cannot stop your children from doing dangerous things. Not always, not forever. Not in every moment from now until death. It is the wise parent who knows this. Yet the parent never stops caring about the outcome. It is this dichotomy, not caring deeply about the process, but caring deeply about the result, that comes close to describing the dichotomy of God. Yet God, in a sense, does not even care about the outcome, not the ultimate outcome. This is because the ultimate outcome is assured. And this is the second great illusion of man, that the outcome of life is in doubt. It is this doubt about ultimate outcome that has created your greatest enemy, which is fear. For if you doubt outcome, then you must doubt Creator. You must doubt God. And if you doubt God, you must live in fear and guilt all your life. If you doubt God's intentions, God's ability to produce this ultimate result, then how can you ever relax? How can you ever truly find peace? Yet God has full power to match intentions with results. You cannot and will not believe in this, even though you claim that God is all-powerful. And so you have to create in your imagination a power equal to God, in order that you may find a way for God's will to be thwarted. So you have created in your mythology the being you call devil. You have even imagined a God at war with this being, thinking that God solves problems the way you do. Finally, you have actually imagined that God could lose this war. All of this violates everything you say you know about God, but this doesn't matter. You live your illusion, and thus feel your fear, all out of your decision to doubt God. But what if you made a new decision? What then would be the result? I tell you this, you would live as the Buddha did, as Jesus did every saint you have ever idolized. Yet, as with most of these saints, people would not understand you. And when you tried to explain your sense of peace, your joy in life, your inner ecstasy, they would listen to your words but not hear them. They would try to repeat your words, but would add to them. They would wonder how you could have what they cannot find. And then they would grow jealous. Soon jealousy would turn to rage, and in their anger they would try to convince you that it is you who do not understand God. And if they were unsuccessful at tearing you from your joy, they would seek to harm you. So enormous would be their rage. And when you told them it does not matter, that even death cannot interrupt your joy nor change your truth, they would surely kill you. Then, when they saw the peace with which you accepted death, they would call you a saint and love you again. For it is the nature of people to love, then destroy, then love again that which they value most.
But why? Why do we do that?
All human actions are motivated at their deepest level by one of two emotions, fear or love. In truth, there are only two emotions, only two words in the language of the soul. These are the opposite ends of the great polarity which I created when I produced the universe and your world as you know it today. These are the two points, the Alpha and the Omega, which allow the system you call relativity to be. Without these two points, without these two ideas about things, no other idea could exist. Every human thought and every human action is based in either love or fear. There's no other human motivation. And all other ideas are but derivatives of these two. They are simply different versions, different twists on the same theme. Think on this deeply, and you will see that it is true. This is what I have called the sponsoring thought. It is either a thought of love or fear. This is the thought behind the thought behind the thought. It is the first thought. It is prime force. It is the raw energy that drives the engine of human experience. And here is how human behavior produces repeat experience after repeat experience. It is why humans love, then destroy, then love again. Always there's the swing from one emotion to the other. Love sponsors fear, sponsors love, sponsors fear. And the reason is found in the first lie. The lie which you hold is the truth about God, that God cannot be trusted, that God's love cannot be depended upon, that God's acceptance of you is conditional, that the ultimate outcome is thus in doubt. For if you cannot depend on God's love to always be there, on whose love can you depend? If God retreats and withdraws when you do not perform properly, will not mere mortals also? And so it is that in the moment you pledge your highest love, you greet your greatest fear. The first thing you worry about after saying, I love you, is whether you'll hear it back. And if you hear it back, then you begin immediately to worry that the love you have just found, you will lose. And so all action becomes a reaction, defense against loss, even as you seek to defend yourself against the loss of God. Yet if you knew who you are, that you are the most magnificent, the most remarkable, the most splendid being God has ever created, you would never fear. For who could reject such wondrous magnificence? Not even God could find fault in such a being. But you do not know who you are. And you think you are a great deal less. Where did you get the idea of how much less than magnificent you are? And the only people whose word you would take on everything are your mother and your father. These are the people who love you the most. Why would they lie to you? Yet have they not told you that you are too much of this and not enough of that? Have they not reminded you that you are to be seen and not heard? Have they not scolded you in some of the moments of your greatest exuberance? And did they not encourage you to set aside some of your wildest imagining? These are the messages you've received. And though they do not meet the criteria and are thus not messages from God, they might as well have been. Though they have come from the gods of your universe, surely enough. It was your parents who taught you that love is conditional. You have felt their conditions many times, and that is the experience you take into your own love relationships. It is also the experience you bring to me. From this experience, you draw your conclusions about me. Within this framework, you speak your truth. God is a loving God, you say. But if you break his commandments, he will punish you with eternal banishment and everlasting damnation. For have you not experienced the banishment of your own parents? Do you not know the pain of their damnation? How, then, could you imagine it to be any different with me? You have forgotten what it was like to be loved without condition. You do not remember
the experience of the love of God. And so you try to imagine what God's love must be like, based on what you see of love in the world. You have projected the role of parent onto God, and have thus come up with a God who judges and rewards or punishes based on how good he feels about what you've been up to. But this is a simplistic view of God, based on your mythology. It has nothing to do with who I am. Having thus created an entire thought system about God, based on human experience rather than spiritual truths, you then create an entire reality around love. It is a fear-based reality, rooted in the idea of a fearful, vengeful God. Its sponsoring thought is wrong. But to deny that thought would be to disrupt your whole theology. And though the new theology, which would replace it, would truly be your salvation, you cannot accept it, because the idea of a God who is not to be feared, who will not judge, and who has no cause to punish, is simply too magnificent to be embraced within your grandest notion of who and what God is. This fear-based love reality dominates your experience of love, indeed actually creates it. For not only do you see yourself receiving love which is conditional, you also watch yourself giving it in the same way. And even while you withhold and retreat and set your conditions, a part of you knows this is not what love really is. Still, you seem powerless to change the way you dispense it. You've learned the hard way, you tell yourself, and you'll be damned if you're going to leave yourself vulnerable again. Yet the truth is, you'll be damned if you don't. By your own mistaken thoughts about love, do you damn yourself never to experience it purely? So too, do you damn yourself never to know me as I really am? Until you do. For you shall not be able to deny me forever. And the moment will come for our reconciliation. Every action taken by human beings is based in love or fear. Not simply those dealing with relationships. Decisions affecting business, industry, politics, religion, the education of your young, the social agenda of your nations, the economic goals of your society, choices involving war, peace, attack, defense, aggression, submission, determinations to covet or give away, to save or to share, to unite or to divide. Every single free choice you ever undertake arises out of one of the only two possible thoughts there are, a thought of love or a thought of fear. Fear is the energy which contracts, closes down, draws in, runs, hides, hoards, harms. Love is the energy which expands, opens up, sends out, stays, reveals, shares, heals. Fear wraps our bodies in clothing. Love allows us to stand naked. Fear clings to and clutches all that we have. Love gives all that we have away. Fear holds close. Love holds dear. Fear grasps. Love lets go. Fear rankles. Love soothes. Fear attacks. Love amends. Every human thought, word, or deed is based in one emotion or the other. You have no choice about this, because there is nothing else from which to choose. But you have free choice about which of these to select.
You make it sound so easy. And yet in the moment of decision, fear wins more often than not. Why is that?
You've been taught to live in fear. You have been told about the survival of the fittest, and the victory of the strongest, and the success of the cleverest. Precious little is said about the glory of the most loving. And so you strive to be the fittest, the strongest, the cleverest, in one way or another. And if you see yourself as something less than this in any situation, you fear loss, for you have been told that to be less is to lose. And so, of course, you choose the action fear sponsors, for that is what you've been taught. Yet I teach you this. When you choose the action love sponsors, then you will do more than survive. Then you will do more than win. Then you will do more than succeed. Then will you experience the full glory of who you really are and who you can be. To do this, you must turn aside the teachings of your well-meaning but misinformed worldly tutors and hear the teachings of those whose wisdom comes from another source. There are many such teachers among you, as always there have been, for I will not leave you without those who would show you, teach you, guide you, and remind you of these truths. Yet the greatest reminder is not anyone outside you, but the voice within you. This is the first tool that I use because it is the most accessible. The voice within is the loudest voice with which I speak because it is the closest to you. It is the voice which tells you whether everything else is true or false, right or wrong, good or bad, as you have defined it. It is the radar that sets the course, steers the ship, guides the journey, if you but let it. It is the voice which tells you right now whether the very words you are listening to are words of love or words of fear. By this measure can you determine whether they are words to heed or words to ignore.
You said that when I always choose the action that love sponsors, then I will experience the full glory of who I am and who I can be. Will you expand on this, please?
There is only one purpose for all of life, and that is for you and all that lives to experience fullest glory. Everything else you say, think, or do is attendant to that function. There is nothing else for your soul to do, and nothing else your soul wants to do. The wonder of this purpose is that it is never-ending. An ending is a limitation, and God's purpose is without such a boundary. Should there come a moment in which you experience yourself in your fullest glory, you will in that instant imagine an ever greater glory to fulfill. The more you are, the more you can become. And the more you can become, the more you can yet be. The deepest secret is that life is not a process of discovery, but a process of creation. You are not discovering yourself, but creating yourself anew. Seek, therefore, not to find out who you are. Seek to determine who you want to be.
There are those who say that life is a school, that we are here to learn specific lessons, that once we graduate, we can go on to larger pursuits, no longer shackled by the body. Is this correct?
It is another part of your mythology based on human experience.
Life is not a school?
Nope.
We're not here to learn lessons?
Nope.
Well, then why are we here?
To remember and recreate who you are. I've told you over and over again, you do not believe me. Yet that is well as it should be. For truly, if you do not create yourself as who you are, that you cannot be.
Okay, all right, you've lost me. Let's go back to this school bit. I've heard teacher after teacher tell us that life is a school. I'm frankly shocked to hear you deny that.
School is a place you go if there is something you do not know that you want to know. It is not a place you go if you already know a thing and simply want to experience your knowingness. Life, as you call it, is an opportunity for you to know experientially what you already know conceptually. You need learn nothing to do this. You need merely remember what you already know and act on it.
I'm not sure I understand.
Let's start here. The soul, your soul, knows all there is to know all the time. There's nothing hidden to it, nothing unknown, yet knowing is not enough. The soul seeks to experience. You can know yourself to be generous, but unless you do something which displays generosity, you have nothing but a concept. You can know yourself to be kind, but unless you do someone a kindness, you have nothing but an idea about yourself. It is your soul's only desire to turn its grandest concept about itself into its greatest experience. Until concept becomes experience, all there is speculation. I have been speculating about myself for a long time, longer than the age of the universe times the age of the universe. You see then how young it is, how new is my experience of myself.
Wait, you've lost me again. Your experience of yourself?
Yes, let me explain it to you this way. In the beginning, that which is all there was, and there was nothing else. Yet, all that is could not know itself, because all that is all there was, and there was nothing else. And so all that is was not. For in the absence of something else, all that is not. This is the great is-not-is to which mystics have referred from the beginning of time. Now, all that is knew it was all there was, but this was not enough, for it could only know its utter magnificence conceptually, not experientially. Yet the experience of itself is that for which it longed, for it wanted to know what it felt like to be so magnificent. Still, this was impossible, because the very term magnificent is a relative term. All that is could not know what it felt like to be magnificent unless that which is not showed up. In the absence of that which is not, that which is not. Do you understand this?
I think so. Keep going.
All right. The one thing that all that is knew is there was nothing else. And so it could and would never know itself from a reference point outside of itself. Such a point did not exist. Only one reference point existed, and that was the single place within, the is not is, the am not am. Still, the all of everything chose to know itself experientially. This energy, this pure, unseen, unheard, unobserved, and therefore unknown by anyone else energy, chose to experience itself as the utter magnificence it was. In order to do this, it realized it would have to use a reference point within. It reasoned, quite correctly, that any portion of itself would necessarily have to be less than the whole, and that if it thus simply divided itself into portions, each portion, being less than the whole, could look back on the rest of itself and see magnificence. And so all that is divided itself, becoming in one glorious moment that which is this and that which is that. For the first time, this and that existed, quite apart from each other. And still, both existed simultaneously, as did all that was neither. Thus, three elements suddenly existed, that which is here, that which is there, and that which is neither here nor there, but which must exist for here and there to exist. It is the nothing which holds the everything. It is the non-space which holds the space. It is the all which holds the parts. Can you understand this? Are you following this?
I think I am, actually. Believe it or not, you've used such a clear illustration that I think I'm actually understanding this.
I'm going to go further. Now, this nothing which holds the everything is what some people call God. Yet that is not accurate either, for it suggests that there is something God is not, namely everything that is not nothing. But I am all things, seen and unseen. So this description of me as the great unseen, the no thing, or the space between, an essentially Eastern mystical definition of God, is no more accurate than the essentially Western practical description of God as all that is seen. Those who believe that God is all that and all that is not are those whose understanding is correct. Now, in creating that which is here and that which is there, God made it possible for God to know itself. In the moment of this great explosion from within, God created relativity, the greatest gift God ever gave to itself. Thus, relationship is the greatest gift God ever gave to you, a point to be discussed in detail later. From the no thing, thus sprang the everything. A spiritual event entirely consistent, incidentally, with what your scientists call the Big Bang Theory. As the elements of all raced forth, time was created. For a thing was first here, then it was there. And the period it took to get from here to there was measurable. Just as the parts of itself which are seen began to define themselves relative to each other, so too did the parts which are unseen. God knew that for love to exist and to know itself as pure love, its exact opposite had to exist as well. So God voluntarily created the great polarity, the absolute opposite of love, everything that love is not, what is now called fear. In the moment fear existed, love could exist as a thing that could be experienced. It is this creation of duality between love and its opposite, which humans refer to in their various mythologies as the birth of evil, the fall of Adam, the rebellion of Satan, and so forth. Just as you have chosen to personify pure love as the character you call God, so have you chosen to personify abject fear as a character you call the devil. Some on earth have established rather elaborate mythologies around this event, complete with scenarios of battles and war, angelic soldiers and devilish warriors, the forces of good and evil, of light and dark. This mythology has been mankind's early attempt to understand and tell others in a way they could understand, a cosmic occurrence of which the human soul is deeply aware, but of which the mind can barely conceive. In rendering the universe as a divided version of itself, God produced from pure energy all that now exists, both seen and unseen. In other words, not only was the physical universe thus created, but the metaphysical universe as well, the part of God which forms the second half of the am-not-am equation, also exploded into an infinite number of units smaller than the whole. These energy units you would call spirits. In some of your religious mythologies, it is stated that God the Father had many spirit children. This parallel to the human experiences of life multiplying itself seems to be the only way the people could be made to hold in reality the idea of the sudden appearance, the sudden existence of countless spirits in the kingdom of heaven. In this instance, your mythical tales and stories are not so far from ultimate reality. For the endless spirits comprising the totality of me are, in a cosmic sense, my offspring. My divine purpose in dividing me was to create sufficient parts of me so that I could know myself experientially. There is only one way for the Creator to know itself experientially as the Creator, and that is to create. And so I gave to each of the countless parts of me, to all of my spirit children, the same power to create which I have as the whole. This is what your religions mean when they say that you were created in the image and likeness of God. This doesn't mean, as some have suggested, that our physical bodies look alike, although God can adopt whatever physical form God chooses for a particular purpose. It does mean that our essence is the same. We are composed of the same stuff. We are the same stuff. with all the same properties and abilities, including the ability to create physical reality out of thin air. My purpose in creating you, my spiritual offspring, was for me to know myself as God. I have no way to do that save through you. Thus it can be said, and has been many times, that my purpose for you is that you should know yourself as me. This seems so amazingly simple, yet it becomes very complex because there is only one way for you to know yourself as me. And that is for you first to know yourself as not me. Now try to follow this. Fight to keep up because this gets very subtle here. Are you ready?
I think so.
Good. Remember, you've asked for this explanation. You've waited for it for years. You've asked for it in layman's terms, not theological doctrines or scientific theories.
Yes, yes. I know what I've asked.
And having asked, so shall you receive. Now, to keep things simple, I'm going to use your Children of God mythological model as a basis for discussion, because it is a model with which you're very familiar, and in many ways, it is not that far off. So let's go back to how this process of self-knowing must work. There is one way I could have caused all of my spiritual children to know themselves as parts of me, and that was simply to tell them. This I did. But you see, it was not enough for spirit to simply know itself as God, or part of God, or children of God, or inheritors of the kingdom, or whatever mythology you want to use. As I've already explained, knowing something and experiencing it are two different things. Spirit longed to know itself experientially, just as I did. Conceptual awareness was not enough for you. So I devised a plan. It is the most extraordinary idea in all the universe and the most spectacular collaboration. I say collaboration because all of you are in it with me. Under the plan, you as spirit would enter the physical universe just created. This is because physicality is the only way to know experientially what you know conceptually. It is, in fact, the reason I created the physical cosmos to begin with, and the system of relativity which governs it, and all creation. Once in the physical universe, you, my spirit children, could experience what you know of yourself, but first you had to come to know the opposite. To explain this simply, you cannot know yourself as tall unless and until you become aware of short. You cannot experience the part of yourself that you call fat unless you also come to know thin. Taken to ultimate logic, you cannot experience yourself as what you are until you've encountered what you are not. This is the purpose of the theory of relativity and all physical life. It is by that which you are not that you yourself are defined. Now, in the case of the ultimate knowing, in the case of knowing yourself as the creator, you cannot experience yourself as creator unless and until you create. And you cannot create yourself until you uncreate yourself. In a sense, you have to first not be in order to be. Do you follow?
I think.
Stay with it. Of course, there's no way for you to not be who and what you are. You simply are that pure creative spirit, have been, always, and always will be. So you did the next best thing. You caused yourself to forget who you really are. Upon entering the physical universe, you relinquished your remembrance of yourself. This allows you to choose to be who you are, rather than simply wake up in the castle, so to speak. It is in the act of choosing to be, rather than simply being told that you are a part of God, that you experience yourself as being at total choice, which is what, by definition, God is. Yet, how can you have a choice about something over which there is no choice? You cannot not be my offspring, no matter how hard you try. But you can forget. You are, have always been, and will always be a divine part of the divine whole, a member of the body. That is why the act of rejoining the whole, of returning to God, is called remembrance. You actually choose to remember who you really are, or to join together with the various parts of you to experience the all of you, which is to say, the all of me. Your job on earth, therefore, is not to learn, because you already know, but to remember who you are, and to remember who everyone else is. That is why a big part of your job is to remind others, that is, to remind them, so that they can remember also. All the wonderful spiritual teachers have been doing just that. It is your soul purpose. That is to say, your soul purpose.
My God, this is so simple and so symmetrical. I mean, it all fits in. It suddenly all fits. I see now a picture I've never quite put together before.
Good. That's good. That is the purpose of this dialogue. You have asked me for answers. I have promised I would give them to you. You will render my words accessible to many people. It is part of your work. Now, you have many questions, many inquiries to make about life. We have here placed the foundation. We've laid the groundwork for other understandings. Let's go to the other questions, and don't worry. If there is something about what we've just gone through you do not understand, it'll all become clear to you soon enough.
There's so much I want to ask. There's so many questions. I suppose I should start with the big ones, the obvious ones. Like, why is the world in the shape it's in?
Of all the questions man has asked of God, this is the one asked most often. From the beginning of time, man has asked it. From the first moment to this, you have wanted to know, why must it be like this? The classic posing of the question is usually something like, if God is all perfect and all loving, why would God create pestilence and famine, war and disease, earthquakes and tornadoes and hurricanes and all manner of natural disaster, deep personal disappointment and worldwide calamity? The answer to this question lies in the deeper mystery of the universe and the highest meaning of life. I do not show my goodness by creating only what you call perfection all around you. I do not demonstrate my love by not allowing you to demonstrate yours. As I've already explained, you cannot demonstrate love until you can demonstrate not loving. A thing cannot exist without its opposite, except in the world of the absolute.